I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Emails released last week revealed some of the inner workings of the Clinton Foundation and the Secretary of State and the State Department when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State. Staffers were in contact about a job request and a request by a foundation donor who wanted to talk with a State Department official about Lebanon. When Hillary Clinton was being confirmed for Secretary of State, she said she'd do everything in her power to separate her job from the work of the global charity. These emails requested by Judicial Watch are the latest in a string of emails that have dogged Clinton's bid for the White House, our topic for today's Radio Times. And let me introduce our three guests. Rebecca Ballhaus is a reporter in the Wall Street Journal's Washington, D.C. Bureau, where she writes about national politics and campaign finance. And Rebecca, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Simon Head, Director of Programs for the New York Review of Books Foundation, also a research fellow at the Institute of Public Knowledge at New York University. Wrote a book called Mindless, Why Smarter Machines Are Making Dumber Humans. Simon Head, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be with you.
And also with us and joining us by Skype is David Graham, a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he covers U.S. politics and global news. And David Graham, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be back.
Rebecca Ballhaus, let me begin with you. And what was Judicial Watch looking for in their request for about 100, or I guess they got about 300 emails?
Right. They got about 300 emails, of which there were about 44 exchanges that weren't handed over to the government as part of Hillary Clinton's archive. And this group, this is a conservative group, they've been looking for any examples they can find of basically what we saw, which was Clinton Foundation officials, aides to Bill Clinton, asking the State Department for what looks like favors. And, you know, as you pointed out, we saw them asking for a meeting on behalf of a major donor to the Clinton Foundation, looking for a job for someone who they've since said was a young advanced staffer who had previously worked for Clinton campaigns, so not a foundation official or donor. But it's an example of how people with ties to the Clinton Foundation had access to the State Department that you really otherwise wouldn't have had.
Anything in these emails that sees Hillary Clinton's involvement in any of this email traffic?
No, we only see her top aides at the State Department engaging. We don't see anything from her personally.
The case involving the expert or the State Department official having to do with Lebanon, there doesn't seem to be a kind of a smoking gun there. Can you flesh that out for us?
Right. I think that's accurate. So what we see in the emails is this top aide to Bill Clinton, Doug Band, who was head of the Clinton Global Initiative at the time. That's a wing of the Clinton Foundation. And he's just asking to set up a meeting with a substance person, as he calls it, at the State Department. They've since said that this guy was just looking to offer his insights on the Lebanese elections, not for any specific action or anything like that from the State Department. So I think you're right that it's not a smoking gun, but I do think that, you know, it's not good optics to have people from the Clinton Foundation looking for access that you otherwise wouldn't have had for someone who's given between $1 million and $5 million to the Clinton Foundation.
David Graham, what's your takeaway from these two emails?
I mean, I think Rebecca is exactly right about that. You've got aides with these longstanding ties in various places, and you know, they can say that Doug Band was acting in a capacity that is separate from the foundation, but it's very hard for the public to know where the line is, and it's unclear whether people inside the State Department would know. So you just see how really inextricable the foundation is from the Clinton family's longstanding ties from the State Department in cases like this.
Quoting from the man who was looking for some contact about Lebanon, his spokesperson said he hasn't had no personal contact with Secretary Clinton or any of her staff since 2006. Never met or had any contact with Ambassador Feltman. Apparently the person he was looking to talk to had no contact of any kind with anyone from the State Department regarding the subject matter of the emails between Mr. Ban and Ms. Abedin. To you, Simon Head, what do you see in these two emails, which is really the focus of our conversation, at least to get this conversation started?
Well, I think we need to broaden the scope of the conversation rather radically. I mean, what I've done in a series of pieces for the New York Review of Books is to look at the sheer scale of what I call conflict of interest involving Hillary and Bill Clinton. I mean, the most scandalous that I came across was a period, I think, in 2011 when Bill Clinton was hired to the tune of about $250,000 a time with organizations, defense organizations, lobbying organizations, which at that very moment were doing business with Hillary Clinton's State Department. Another absolutely crass example of this was the case of UBS when the Swiss foreign minister was lobbying Hillary Clinton about penalties to be levied against UBS. And UBS was paying out hundreds of thousands of dollars to Bill Clinton to give a series of seminars to UBS employees. And you can go on and on with these kind of examples, and I do. And I think, again, as has been said, is there a smoking gun? Well, usually the smoking gun isn't there, but the appearance of impropriety and of conflict of interest is on a colossal scale. To me, that disqualifies Hillary Clinton, frankly, from being president. And if anybody else than Trump who was against her, I think she'd be in deep trouble.
Well, I want to pick up on that, but let me go back to you, Rebecca Ball. And there is this question about whether there's quid pro quo involved or whether it's more the appearance of some potential conflict that Simon was just referring to. Is there any way to flesh that out?
Well, so I think what we've seen, we've been reporting on this for almost 2 years now, and we, as Simon says, we've found a lot of incidents where it looks bad, but we have yet to find any specific smoking gun. We don't have any evidence of a quid pro quo, but you do see a lot of overlaps between companies that, for example, lobby the State Department while giving to her foundation. So we did a story last year that found at least 60 companies that lobbied the State Department during her tenure and donated a total of more than $26 million to the Clinton Foundation. The UBS example that Simon brought up is another good one. They dramatically ramped up their donations to the Clinton Foundation and their payments to Bill Clinton for speaking fees after Hillary had this unusual intervention as Secretary of State in their tax case. So we don't have any examples of specific action that you can see that we know was taken because of a donation, but there are countless examples of this kind of overlap that doesn't look good.
Well, let me go to you, David. And you wrote a piece recently looking at the numbers of controversies, even scandals that have followed the Clinton for decades now. And there's always a question about, is this a vast right-wing conspiracy? Is this something that the Clintons themselves bring on themselves? How do we answer that?
It often seems like something that's in between. And you get cases where the reasons for which the Clintons are being investigated look a little bit questionable. You look at a case like Whitewater, which was heavily litigated, heavily investigated, and didn't really produce much in the way of any wrongdoing on the part of the Clintons. But it did end up leading investigators to other things, such as the Monica Lewinsky scandal, in which Bill Clinton was impeached for lying under oath. Emails, I feel like, are another example of this sort of thing. You know, they came about through the Benghazi investigation, which ended up with no finding of malfeasance on the part of Hillary Clinton. But through that, we found about these emails, and from emails, we're finding out various other ties and questionable relationships. So there's a little bit of both things going on. There's some questionable business, but there's also often a witch hunt going on that leads to that questionable business.
How do you then deal with that, Simon? I mean, you're pretty outspoken in saying that this really disqualifies her for the White House. If there is no proven quid pro quo, what happened? How do you move forward on that?
Well, I want to mention what I think is the most scandalous case of all, and that is the relation of the Clintons to the regime in Colombia. I mean, you had a president of Colombia when Hillary became Secretary of State, who'd been deeply implicated as an ally of the drugs cartel. And you had Bill Clinton lobbying this president on behalf of one of his clients, a Canadian called Gistra, for concessions in Colombian oil, Colombian timber, Colombian minerals. Despite the fact that, as Human Rights Watch shows, the human rights record of that regime was absolutely deplorable. You also had Hillary Clinton coming in at a critical moment as Secretary of State when the deal between Gistra and the Colombians was ripening, giving a completely fictitious account of human rights in Colombia. So what's going on there? you know, whitewashing the Colombians at a time when there were, I mean, for example, there was liquidation of trade union leaders going on in Colombia.
And I mean, I think those are all very important and certainly legitimate questions. How does that, though, from your perspective, Simon Head, since Bernie Sanders now supports Hillary Clinton, Elizabeth Warren does as well, they have given their seal of approval to her. Does that in any way mollify some of your concerns?
No. I mean, you know, they're doing it on the basis of political calculation. And I think there's a case to be made, if you look at Trump, that I'm not a U.S. citizen. One holds one nose and votes for Hillary. But you know, as reporters, and I'm an academic, it doesn't mean that we lose sight of this record of sort of gross, in a way, impropriety. And you know, think back to some of the great American figures of the past. Think of George C. Marshall and Dean Acheson. Do you really think they would engage in any of this kind of thing? I mean, I think it does indicate a very, very radical decline in the standards of public life that Hillary and Bill can get away with this over a long period of time.
Do you see it that way, David Graham?
I think it's hard to find an analogy that really fits. And I'm hesitant about things. I mean, you have State Departments and American diplomats and leaders making decisions that that put them in bed with unsavory leaders around the world for decades, for centuries. But the problem is that you never have a situation where, on the one hand, you have the leader of American foreign policy, and on the other hand, you have that leader's spouse who happens to be a former president. It's really an unusual and in fact, unique situation. And so you have these ties. You have people who have been close to the Clinton family for years. You have people who want to give to the Clinton Foundation to get close to Bill Clinton. And you have the fact that Bill Clinton is married to Hillary Clinton. You know, there's all these, whether or not there's a smoking gun, there are these appearances of conflict of interest that are very hard to get around. And of course, that's really how conflict of interest works, is it's about appearance as much as it is about finding the actual smoking gun.
And Rebecca, we're almost having a break here, but probably in history, there is no arrangement or Clinton Foundation, while the spouse of the founder of a foundation is also Secretary of State.
Right. I think that's the unprecedented nature of this is also what makes it really tricky. And I think also further complicating things is the fact that they haven't been super clear about what will happen with the foundation if Hillary Clinton does become president. They've said there's no way it can continue to exist in the same way. She's, of course, taken her name off the foundation since starting to run for president. But it would be very difficult to have Bill Clinton still be raising money for the foundation if she's in the White House. And they haven't explicitly said what would happen with the organization if that does happen.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about the Clinton Foundation. Some of the questions raised about the Clinton Foundation during the time that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, and that's Rebecca Ballhaus. She's a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, also with us Simon Head, Director of Programs at the New York Review of Books Foundation, wrote a book called Mindless, Why Smarter Machines Are Making Dumber Humans. And David Graham is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He covers U.S. politics and global news. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499, the number to call to join our conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are talking about the Clinton Foundation in this hour with David Graham, Simon Head, and Rebecca Ballhaus. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Rebecca, you've been covering the Clinton Foundation for some time now. Any questions been raised about the work that the Clinton Foundation actually does? Okay. Apparently, David, we have a little bit of a technical problem, so we're going to get our other guests up. But let me put that question to you about if there are questions about what the actual this global charity, what it actually does.
Whether the aid that it produces is effective?
Yes.
There are questions about you know, who they're working with, and there are questions about how it overlaps with American foreign policy. You know, at what places they're interacting with you know, concerns that have business before the State Department. There's also questions about, you know, what Bill Clinton is doing in terms of sort of work and lobbying and how that intersects with the Clinton Foundation. So, for example, you have this complicated deal involving uranium and the Russian government and State Department approval, which touches on the foundation and it touches on Bill Clinton and it touches on Hillary Clinton's State Department as well. So they're very complicated things where you see these interests being intermingled.
I was also reading that State Department has ethics officers are checking for conflict of interest or any kind of interest violations. Does that put in some kind of a check system on this relationship between or this past relationship between the Clinton Foundation and the State Department?
I think certainly in theory it does, and you want to see those sorts of controls. And often what you see in the situations is the this bizarre. It's hard to even summarize this uranium case. You've got so many different levels of connection, and it becomes so tenuous that it's hard to point to one place where something crosses a line. But if you look at the situation overall, I think it, you know, a lot of people look at it and say there's something funky going on here, and it looks questionable.
Again, looking at the piece that you did, kind of linking all these various allegations, some of them controversies, some of them. I think vast right-wing conspiracies, and some of them also the potential of some kind of scandal or violation. What is it you think about the Clintons that seems to create such drama?
I think that there are a couple things, and one of them is simply the length of their time in public service. You know, this is a family that has been highly involved at the highest levels of American politics for coming up on 30 years, and so as a result, they're going to have ties to people that simply not many other people have. Thinking back on a politician or a family with the same sorts of ties, you'd have to go back perhaps to George H.W. Bush, who was in fact swept up in things like Iran-Contra. So there's a kind of, the longer you stay in Washington, the longer you get involved with these things situation. And I think with the Clintons, the other thing that goes on is there seems to be an ongoing concern about money, really going back to very early in their lives when Bill Clinton was not making a great deal of money as a public official in Arkansas. And so you see the Clintons doing things to try to make that up, starting with the Whitewater investment and running up through these highly lucrative speeches that both of them gave following Bill Clinton leaving the White House and Hillary Clinton leaving the State Department, which have raised other questions, for example, about ties to Goldman Sachs with ethics for the two of them.
Well, and the Clinton Foundation, started by Bill Clinton, I guess, after he left the White House, with what to do, I guess, with his enormous influence and power and contacts.
That's right, and you can imagine why he doesn't want to squander or you know, sort of let those things slip. He's a man who obviously loves getting his hands into things and working on the issues. But it's very hard to have him doing these things as a sort of freelance, quasi non-governmental figure at the same time that his wife is leading American foreign policy.
And how about now that she's running for president? I mean, it's interesting that these emails, there is the kind of drip, drip, drip of these emails since that Benghazi revelation, that this is something that that Hillary Clinton can't seem to put to rest or put to sleep in some kind of way. Is that because she doesn't want to talk to the press about it? How do you see that?
She seems to have repeatedly failed to come up with a sort of a pithy and straightforward answer. And I think in some cases the reason for that is that there is no good answer. You know, she clearly should not have been using the State Department email system. And while she's apologized for that, she has also sort of tried to shade it in ways and defend it. And really, there's just not a good way to explain why she felt it was important to go against security suggestions and also against public records rules to produce her own email system. It simply can't be explained away in any very effective way.
I began by talking about these two emails that were revealed, two out of a bunch that were released last week. And again, you know, you don't see the kind of smoking gun. It sounds like some staffers talking amongst themselves, talking about the possibility of setting up some kind of an interview or some kind of a conversation that never actually took place, which does make you wonder whether it's underlings just trying to mollify someone, but it never sort of gets up to the boss.
That's an interesting point. And you know, we're looking at these emails more closely than we look at the emails of any other public officials because there's this new scrutiny. And so a lot of it is, I'm sure, simply noise. You know, think about all of the the emails you send in the course of a day
sure.
that are don't really mean much. But the question is, you know, which do and don't. And because of the close ties that for example, that Simon was pointing out and Rebecca, it's hard to know which things are entirely harmless noise and which things suggest some sort of nefarious connection.
Well, and even some of the emails that we've led, there is a kind of cluelessness, and I can relate to Hillary Clinton because I'm kind of her age, a kind of a cluelessness about some of this email traffic.
So many of these emails are simply, please print, with some sort of article that Clinton wants released. There are early ones that showed her trying to figure out how to, I believe, find an NPR station on Long Island while driving. So there is a lot of that stuff in there, too.
I think we have Rebecca Ballhaus. We're having some technical problems here. Rebecca, do we have you back?
Yes.
Okay, and I apologize for that. I'm not exactly sure what's going on with our system, but it seemed to have dumped you. And I'm not sure how much longer you can stay on with us. We had you booked till about 10:30.
Yes.
Okay, well, anything you want to add, and perhaps even looking forward, are there more emails to be released, especially from Judicial Watch?
You know, I don't know the exact number of emails that Judicial Watch has left, but they seem to have been releasing them, you know, in batches pretty periodically. I think they likely intend to keep that going through the end of the election. But, you know, what we've seen is just that these overlaps sort of persist. And I think one thing that we maybe haven't mentioned about one of the top aides who was engaging in these emails with Doug Band, Huma, is that she was also employed by the Clinton Foundation at the same time as she was working for the State Department. So I think that's just, you know, another example of how there are so many overlaps in all these different areas of Clinton world.
Now, I read, or perhaps she said, that she was a volunteer or non-paid person working for the foundation. Does that make a difference? Is that true?
Right. She received this special designation that she was allowed by the State Department to also be employed elsewhere at the same time.
Have you talked directly or asked Hillary Clinton any questions about some of these questions?
No, I have not been given the opportunity. She rarely does press conferences.
What would you want to ask her?
I think I'd want to ask her whether she thinks that this looks bad. You know, I think this is, as much as anything else, an optics issue. As you say, we don't have a smoking gun. Does she think that it's a problem, the way this looks, and what steps would she take as president to reduce that conflict of interest, at least in appearance?
Well, Rebecca, I'm sorry to we lost you for a bit, but thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Reporter in the Wall Street Journal's Washington, D.C. Bureau, and she's been writing about national politics and campaign finance. I believe we have Simon Head back. Are you back with us on Radio Times?
I'm with you.
Okay, sorry about that. And again, Director of Programs for the New York Review of Books Foundation. He's also a research fellow at the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University, wrote a book called Mindless, Why Smarter Machines Are Making Dumber Humans. And David Graham's been staying with us for the hour, staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers U.S. politics and global news. And you can join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a comment from Kathy. Is there any public official whose emails have undergone the scrutiny that Hillary has? I believe smoking guns would be found in many other politicians' emails if examined to the same extent. Simon Head, can you respond to that?
I can't, actually, but I think there's a lot of material there to examine. I do want to make a point, which I'd have made earlier if I hadn't been cut off, and that is that if you're looking at the whole relationship of the Clintons to money, I think it's helpful to distinguish three massive flows going to them, which are distinct. The first is campaign finance contributions, and that goes way back to when Bill Clinton started in national politics in the early 90s, when Robert Rubin, then a senior partner of Goldman Sachs, was a key figure in getting the campaign contributions flowing. And, of course, that carries on when Hillary becomes a serious candidate. The second huge flow of funds, which we haven't really talked about but should, are lecture fees. The Clintons have earned over $100 million between them from lectures. And they're both, how should we say, ruthless in extracting maximum from the lecture fee circuit. And the third, of course, is the contributions to the Clinton Foundation. So I think it's very important to see these flows in relation to one another and how, from the point of view of the donors and the mega donors like Goldman Sachs, they could be a mechanism for reinforcing influence.
Well, David, our emailer wanted to know, you know, if anyone else's emails had been so deeply scrutinized, what would be found on them that might hurt a candidacy or something like that? What do you say to that?
I was trying to think about that while Simon was talking. It's hard for me to think of an example of a politician on this level who's had his or her emails examined in this kind of detail. There's not a case that's coming to light. And I think there's a certain irony to that in that Clinton, it appears, at the very least, bent, if not broke, rules about what should be done with public records and in keeping her emails. And the result is now we are looking at these emails much more closely than we have at other people before. You know, the Clinton aides and the Clinton campaign have argued, for example, that the things that she's doing were very similar to what former Secretaries of State Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice were doing. But, of course, neither of those people is running for president, which is why she gets special scrutiny.
Well, and picking up something you said, Simon Head, about the Clintons ruthlessly extracting, I guess, high fees for giving their speeches, do you think they strong-arm people more than anybody else? I mean, I think what we learn from some of these speeches that high-profile people give is that they get paid a lot of money.
Well, there was an extraordinary article which appeared in the Washington Post, which gave a week-by-week log of Bill Clinton's lectures, I think soon after he stood down for the presidency. It's unbelievable. He was making four or five a week. He would talk to practically anybody, the funeral directors, the chicken farmers, you name it. He was there for them. So there's a kind of lust about earning big money from lecture fees. And, of course, with Hillary, there's the problem with Goldman Sachs, that she took $750,000 from Goldman Sachs at a time when Goldman Sachs was deep in legal problems. There were many lawsuits hovering over Goldman Sachs to be bought by various federal agencies, including the Department of Justice. And soon after Hillary gave the lectures, they were fined $6 billion. $6 billion, which carries with it, I think, an implication of extreme culpability. And that's why people want to know what Hillary actually said to Goldman Sachs in those three lectures. She'd given the impression that she was critical of them. She was holding them to task. But there are very good reasons to doubt whether she, in fact, was. And, of course, she's refused to release the transcripts, rather like Nixon and the tapes. And I think she should be held to account on that.
What do you think about that, David? Should she be held to account? And how would someone hold her to account?
Well, I mean, I think the difference between the Nixon tapes and this is that these were done, you know, the Nixon tapes were made as part of official business. But I also think they are a political liability for her, and I think people are right to want to know what is in them. And I think, you know, even if there's no way to compel that other than political pressure, it makes sense to push because for all the reasons that Simon raises. You know, I think one of the more interesting moments in the Democratic debates was this moment of kind of radical, perhaps mistaken honesty by Clinton when she was asked why she took $250,000 from Goldman Sachs to give these speeches. And her answer is, well, that's what they offered. Which is, I think, an answer that makes a lot of sense, but from a certain perspective. But as a matter of politics, it's sort of baffling, you know, why she thought it would be a good idea with a potential presidential run in her future to give these speeches, knowing that people would want to know what was in them is a little bit mysterious.
I mean, in many ways, that's a political question about why give the speech, David, and then also run for the White House.
Sure. It seems like there are two obvious choices. One is to become a full-time lecturer and you know, circuit speaker, and one is to keep presidential hopes alive. And trying to combine those is a dangerous trick, and we're seeing the blowback for her right now.
Simon, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I mean, I want to make the point that these speeches are complete boilerplate. I mean, if you did see the Goldman Sachs taped texts,
right,
they're significant insofar that I very much doubt that she does take Goldman Sachs to task. In fact, we know she doesn't, because one of her speeches at the Clinton Global Initiative is on tape. You can see it on YouTube, and it's schmoozing. You know, Lloyd Blankfein is there, and she just schmoozes. There's not one word of criticism from her. So I think that's one reason for wanting to see them.
Well, And I would agree with you on that. I mean, if it's boilerplate, I think the question, Simon, looking ahead, if she becomes the president, is she in the pocket of Goldman Sachs? Now, she's certainly been very critical of Wall Street and has promised many things on the campaign trail that she would do to rein in big banks and the kind of excessive risk-taking that the banks did.
Well, I think if one looks at this whole history, going back 30 years, and the enormous sums of money that not only Wall Street but large corporations have funneled to the Clintons, what I think they're basically trying to do is to make sure that things remain more or less the same. I mean, they're not so crass that they're trying to exclude any kind of reform, but they want to exclude the kind of radicalism that Bernie Sanders stood for. I think Bernie Sanders was the real thing. I think if you look at his policy ideas going back 30 years, he's a real social democrat. That's what he is. He defined himself as a Northern European social democrat, which is what I am.
Mm-hmm.
And from our point of view, American capitalism is deeply flawed, and there's grounds for radical reform of it. And I think that what these gigantic contributions to the Clintons are intended to do in a kind of broad strategic sense is to prevent that. To prevent a kind of radicalism, which one, of course, saw in the 1930s. If you want to see the real precedent for Bernie Sanders, go and look at FDR's speech at Madison Square Garden in 1936. It's a great radical speech. And that is what capital and corporations want to prevent. And I think that is the strategic goal of the gigantic sums they're funneling to the Clintons. And I think they'll probably succeed.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Simon Head. Also with us, David Graham. We are talking about some of the emails released last week that show there was some contact between staffers at the Clinton Foundation and the State Department when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. Simon Head, David Graham, our guest, and you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with David Graham from The Atlantic and Simon Head from New York University. And we are talking about the Clinton Foundation. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. David, let me pick up on something that Simon said right before the break. Do you see Hillary Clinton in a sense, doing the bidding for Goldman Sachs?
Well, I think the easiest way for her to have, I mean, this is sort of Monday morning political consulting, but the easiest way for her to avoid these questions is would have been to not give speeches to Goldman Sachs. And, you know, and I think her record is a mix. You see, for example, she has been pushing a series of tougher policies toward Wall Street, certainly than the Republican Party would have, if less tough than Bernie Sanders. She also has a long history of ties to the industry, both as the senator from New York and also, for example, through members of the first Clinton administration, the Bill Clinton administration. So, you know, you can make an argument both ways, and the only way we will know for sure, I suppose, is if she wins the election and has a chance to make policy.
Let me read an email from Beverly. Simon Head, I'll put this to you. She says, what about all the evidence that for each complaint detractors have against Hillary? There are a myriad of prominent men who have done far more egregious things, and they have not been targeted for their actions. There is not only sexism at play here, but also a stunning long-term hatred of Hillary, who has been too independent as a woman. Simon Head, what do you say?
I don't think that's right. But there are people who've been severely criticized for their conduct, the most obvious being Richard Nixon, who was forced, who was impeached and had to resign the presidency.
I mean, he broke laws, and we don't know that about Hillary Clinton.
No, but I think I do think that for people aspiring to the very high offices of the state, there are, I mean, I don't want to sound pompous, I think there are codes of conduct which should be observed, and the avoidance of the appearance of conflict is one of them, and I think she's violated that on a huge scale. I think they both have, and I think she has to be held accountable. It's nothing to do with sexism. I mean, I'm hugely a great admiration for Elizabeth Warren, who'd have made a much better candidate than Hillary. I very much admire Angela Merkel in the European context. So I really don't think it's a question of sexism.
But as you mentioned, you were Bernie Sanders. Sounds like you still are a Bernie Sanders supporter. But as we know, Hillary Clinton, for a myriad of reasons, won the nomination. So she is the candidate. I mean, I think she borrowed some ideas clearly from Bernie Sanders, but she's the one, at least for the Democrats, Simon Head.
Yeah, and that gives her a certain legitimacy. And, you know, if I was a U.S. citizen, I'd vote for her. In part because Trump is such a terrible candidate. But I don't think we should simply forget about this record because of that. I think it's very relevant if she does become president. We have to be on the lookout to see whether these characteristics persist into her presidency.
David, your thoughts. And then I want to read some more comments, and we got some folks who want to join the conversation as well.
I think it is both true that there is a sexist cast to a great deal of criticism of Hillary Clinton over the years. You know, going back to the Arkansas Project, looking at some of the things that have been said about her and the way that there's a sort of weird cottage industry around taking Clinton down. But I also think it is true that there are legitimate and serious questions about the conflict of interest with the foundation and the State Department and with her handling of emails and so on and so forth. So, you know, we should be on guard against unfairly sexist criticism, but that does not mean that there are not also some very legitimate critiques to be made.
And that seems to be that seems to me, David, the perspective on the Clintons, which is that people hold them to a certain kind of exacting standard, and they also seem to do things that invite criticism.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
And did you want to add to that, Simon?
Well, I don't think the standards are particularly exacting. I mean, to say that, you know, the dealings the Clintons had with the Colombians, you know, was reprehensible, it really isn't to hold them to very exacting standards. You know, similarly, something we haven't mentioned, Bill Clinton's dealings with Kazakhstan, which were extremely seedy. You know, I think they've done things again and again which show an extreme disregard for the standards that high officials should live up to. I don't think we're being particularly exacting with them.
Let me read an email from Stone Harbor. Contributions to the Clinton Foundation rose dramatically and from significant sources with U.S. diplomatic ties when Clinton became the Secretary of State. Comment? Question mark. David, can you answer that?
I don't know the specific numbers. I mean, I think it is true that people understandably saw the Clinton Foundation as a way to get close to Bill Clinton and from there to get close to Hillary Clinton. We don't have any hard evidence of quid pro quos, but you can see why if you were a wealthy foreign figure who wanted to influence the State Department, you might think that was at least a wise investment to give it a shot.
Yeah, well, let me just mention there's this character called Bound who worked for the Clinton Global Initiative, who was the kind of mechanic of organizing access to the Clintons, particularly Bill Clinton, you know, who gets to appear with Bill Clinton on the dais. There's one case, excellent piece of investigative reporting in the New Republic, when the CEO of Coca-Cola got onto the dais with Bill Clinton because presumably he'd given him a handsome contribution. So there was a kind of crassness about what went on at the Clinton Global Initiative, which is comparable to a lot of things they've done.
Well, and I wonder, David, just picking out, since Simon used the word crass, whether there's just a kind of a crassness to our politics, and certainly when you mix money and politics, a serious crassness.
I mean, I think it's true. I think there is a crassness to politics, and some of that is it comes with the territory. Some of it is the sort of stuff that campaign finance reformers have repeatedly tried to fight, often with not a great deal of success. I think, you know, this is a little bit different. This isn't just about the sort of money being speech and buying influence within the U.S. political system here. It's the idea that money is moving into personal pockets of the Clinton, not just campaign coffers, but personal pockets of the Clintons through speeches and the like and to the foundation, which is not personal pockets, but that is a sort of potting money for them, and then affects policy on the other side.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. There's something industrial about the Clinton system. I mean, there's the three channels, which I mentioned, and there's just the sheer scale of it and the the determination whereby the Clintons go after it. I mean, I can't think of anything comparable to that, just the industrial scale in recent American politics.
I mean, the fact that they have made so much money and are
perhaps
so good at it.
Yeah, I mean, they're raising money for campaign contributions from Goldman Sachs, and they're raising huge sums of money for the lecture fees, then they're raising money through the Clinton Foundation. All three going flat out. You're talking big, big money, and you're giving corporate donors three different channels to earn the goodwill of the Clintons. It's just the sheer scale of it.
And my understanding is the Clinton Foundation has raised over the years something like $2 billion. So clearly a lot of money. It has gotten some high marks from Charity Watch, gave it an A in terms of how it invests its money into programs all around the world. Something like almost 90% of that money goes into actual programs. Let me get Jeanette from Bedminster to join us. Jeanette, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have Jeanette? We seem to be having some technical problems here, which is very frustrating. Jeanette says, why is it when people like the Clintons are out to make a living on the speech circuit, that makes a difference? Does it not? Does it make that they are being paid? And I think we just lost one of our guests as well. I heard that. Do we have you, Simon? No, we lost Simon. Okay, David Graham. This is so much fun. Let me ask you something. Let me ask you something about we just learned about Hillary Clinton's tax returns. She released them. They made something like $10 million last year. Obviously, a very good salary. Paid about 30-some percent in terms of their taxes. Any significance to what you saw in their tax returns?
And I think the money is a high number, although people may be at some point sort of inured to it. You know, I think the tax rate itself is interesting. The fact that they're paying a fairly solid number, not it appears paying a very low rate. I didn't see anything else in particular that jumped out at me. But I'm looking forward to looking a little bit more closely.
And I've even heard criticisms of people saying, "Well, she knew she was running for president, so they pay this high tax rate." I mean, it seems like in many ways that they can't win.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting question. I don't know what the argument is that she should have paid less. I mean, and this cuts both ways. You've seen in the case of politicians like Mitt Romney, him arguing, well, look, I took advantage of these tax rates because of the tax rates that are there, and it's reasonable. And if the tax rate should be higher, that's a separate conversation. But in any case, I think it is, unlike perhaps giving speeches to Goldman Sachs, it is politically wise for the Clintons to have paid 34% or so.
Do you think she'd be having bigger troubles as a candidate if she weren't running against Donald Trump?
I think absolutely. You know, every time it seems like there's a damaging Clinton story that could become sort of snowball and get a lot of press attention, as these things do, Trump manages to step on it by saying something more outlandish or more distracting or self-damaging. And so that's really, I think, given her some cover. And she's responded by, to a great extent, lying low and trying to stay out of the spotlight, and that seems to be working well.
She did say, I believe this was in Philadelphia, and I do believe she said it in other places as well, that if she becomes the president, one of the first things she's going to do is to figure out how to undo Citizens United. And we've been talking about, you know, the ways that wealthy corporations and individuals can have influence on elections and can raise lots of money and support candidates or support things like super PACs. Is she lying to us, David, when she talks about some of these more progressive ideas?
I don't know that she is necessarily lying any more than other Democrats. I mean, Bernie Sanders said the same thing, that he would want to repeal Citizens United. And what they have here is, I think, a sincere desire to reform campaign finance. This is a longstanding Democratic priority, and I think a lot of Democrats feel that it would level the playing field a little bit on their behalf, even if in recent years, fundraising has been often very good for Democrats. The problem is that it's one thing to say that; it's another thing to actually do so. Because you have to change constitutional law. So you have to appoint people to the Supreme Court, and then you have to have the case there, and then they have to decide it the way you want. So it's one thing to say it, and another thing to actually do it.
Unfortunately, we've lost Simon Head, and I can't put some questions to you. But I'm curious because he's clearly a Clinton, both Clinton critic. I clearly wish someone else were actually running for the Democratic, as a Democrat for the White House. And there are a lot of bruised feelings, I think, about the Clintons as well, and also people that feel like there's something borderline criminal about what they do. You've looked at a lot of these scandals over the years. What is driving that, do you think?
I mean, I think it's, a lot of it is partisanship. The reason that Republicans wanted to get Bill Clinton in the 90s to a great extent was because he was the Democratic president, and they didn't want to have to deal with that. And you had a particularly sort of militant leader in the House, and Newt Gingrich, who was pursuing unusual tactics. And so then you have this sort of ongoing tension. We've got an even more polarized situation perhaps today than we did then. And so it's sort of the way of partisan battles. There does seem to be something in particular about the Clintons that infuriates a lot of conservatives and liberals as well. Mm-hmm. And I think, you can point to a lot of different causes on that, whether that is sexism or a serious whiff of corruption. And I think it varies a lot from person to person on why people individually feel that way.
Let me read a couple of comments here. Tom from North Philadelphia says, what the Clintons have done doesn't even hold a candle to the Bush family. I understand the Clintons have gray areas, but they do not compare to other political families. Now, we have, we certainly have some dynasties in this country, including some current dynasties. And I'm seeing a fair amount of pushback on some of what we've been talking about this morning, David.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think they don't all work in the same way. One reason for that is that we have had very few presidents who left the White House as young as Bill Clinton did. And so they haven't really had the opportunity to embark on these kind of freelance diplomatic careers as he has, which adds another dimension. And we also haven't had a spousal relationship. George W. Bush, I think, owes a lot of his success to his father and those connections. But you've got the kind of Fahrenheit 9/11-y conspiracy theories about connections with 9/11. But in terms of the proven, I think, there's just more opportunities for questions and for smoke in the Clinton case.
Dorsey from Newcastle, Delaware says Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell also use private servers. Hillary Clinton might have been told, and sort of raises a question about this private server. And I guess, David, I mean, this has really dogged her, these emails and her use of this private server that she says she regrets she ever did for, I think, some very obvious reasons.
I think that's true that they, I'd have to check the details. I believe that they used personal email accounts, but not private servers, which is a sort of an additional innovation by Clinton. But again, they should not have done that. I think that's been called out, but they're also not running for president. And so presidential candidates are, I think, rightly held to a different standard.
What questions would you want to ask Hillary Clinton, David Graham?
Oh, man. I mean, there's so many. And it's almost like it's a fantasy draft to imagine where you would start, because she's given so few interviews and even fewer press conferences. So that the chance to actually ask a question, I think, is an important one. I think maybe, with a nod toward what Rebecca pointed out earlier, the first place would be to ask a very direct question about what specifically she will do about the Clinton Foundation if she wins, how she will handle it. Will it be shut down? Will it be mothballed? And what will Bill Clinton's role be?
All important questions. David Graham, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, covers U.S. politics and global news. We also spoke with Simon Head from the New York Review of Books Foundation and from New York University, and Rebecca Ballhaus. She's a reporter at The Wall Street Journal. And we had some technical problems, so my apologies for that. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.